Monday meeting of the SIR II committee, and we are going to step out of order for a little bit and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 214A. And we would ask Senator Atkins if he would come forward. Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Perhaps one of my favorite committees, the SIR II committee, and it brings me great pleasure to come before you today out of order, bring you out of order. This bill, many of you recall from last session, a bill that was entitled House Bill 3609. 3609 was a bill that began to look at plans that are made between the state of Oregon and various Indian nations in Oregon to return fish. Reader's Digest version of what happened over the course of 5 months that we worked on the bill was that the bill was ultimately signed by the governor after it passed both the House and the Senate unanimously. It was one of the few bills that was a major shift in policy but did pass unanimously. That bill did have a sunset provision attached to it. The sunset provision allowed us to get back to you essentially right now and say, or give you an update on how is it being implemented. And the implementation has had some, I guess you could say, speed bumps along the way. Things have slowed it down, and we have had put it back on the tracks a couple of times. But we are at the point, and I should say after about the last year, of having a real positive implementation of the policy, and feel that both interest sides, the state, various conservation groups, tribes, support repealing the sunset and letting the policy stand. And so this bill simply allows the sunset to go away and allows the work that we've begun to continue. I have faith that it be hopefully carried through on the House side to passage also. With that, I'd like to answer any questions from Representative Cruz. I mean, from the whole committee.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Cruz.
Thank you.
Yeah, I miss you guys. I knew I'd get haggled over here right after lunch.
Well, hey. Yeah, it's good to see my old friend again. We hardly see each other. We're so far apart now. Not so much a question, Mr. Chair, just a comment that, interestingly enough, from my perspective, the department was dragged kicking and screaming towards this position, and yet we find now, for example, in the overview they did over fish before session, they were indeed bragging about this program. So I think we have come an incredibly long way. And I think it would be incredibly short-sighted if we didn't continue the process. So I thank the good senator for bringing this bill before us.
Thank you very much, Representative Cruz.
Any other questions of Senator Atkins? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with this much success before this committee, I'll come back much more often.
Okay. It's always a pleasure to work here, Bill.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you. Let's call Kay Brown from the Department of Fish and Wildlife in to finish on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Kay Brown. I'm with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have a couple of comments on Senate Bill 214. We just want to let you know that the department is currently engaged in the Northwest Power Planning Council's sub-basin planning process. It intends to use this forum for the development of basin plans and for government-to-government consultations. All parties to the Columbia Basin Fish Management Plan are active players in the Council's new sub-basin process. We believe this forum provides the best public process for developing basin plans, allowing for discussion and resolutions of issues among the parties. We are not aware of any conflicts between the Council's basin planning process and the requirements that are listed in Section 2 of the bill. We do intend to report progress to the appropriate legislative committees, but we would suggest reporting at six-month intervals rather than three to reduce the reporting workload on our agency fishery staff who are badly overworked and it would help us if we could lengthen that process out just a little bit. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions to the department? Did we address the 6 months issue on the side?
Mr. Chair, we did. And there was no action taken on it, on our comment.
Okay. Any further questions of the department? Thank you, Kay. At this point, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill, or Senate Bill 214, and we'll go back to our informational meeting. We will first open a work session on introduction of committee bills. We have a committee bill 3194.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC 3194 is modifying membership of the State Fish and Wildlife Commission, requires that members represent specific geographic regions and interests, requires that the commission hold monthly meetings in geographically diverse areas, and it specifies that current members of the commission are dismissed and new members be appointed.
Mr. Chair?
Questions?
No, I'm just going to make a move that we adopt this as a committee rule.
Go ahead.
Bill.
Representative Smith moves we adopt LC 3194 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, would the chair be interested in an amendment to the bill? I guess the one thing, if we're going to make additional changes, would be currently the members of the commission serve four-year terms. Most commissions serve four-year terms at the pleasure of the governor. This commission does not. Would you be interested in modifying those terms also in this?
Members and Representative Cruz, certainly the chair would be willing to entertain amendments to the bill. Right now, the primary purpose of this bill is to get it on the table so it's an issue of discussion. And that's what the agenda is at this particular point.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I bring this up so then we can have the amendment drafted for the further discussion.
Right.
So, okay.
Other discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. At this point, we will open our informational meeting, and Dartmouth Power Planning Council and Eric Block has been sitting patiently waiting for us here. Excuse us, and thank you, Eric.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks very much for the opportunity to come before you and talk a little bit about the Northwest Power Planning Council and what we've been up to. I am one of Oregon's two representatives to the Northwest Power Planning Council. I share that distinction with a gentleman by the name of John Brigiotti, who comes out of Pendleton. Just for members who may not be familiar, the Northwest Power Planning Council is a four-state compact agency comprised of two representatives each from the states of Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Idaho. It is product of the Northwest Power Act, which was a federal law enacted in 1980, which allowed the states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana to create through compact this council. Our mission, broadly speaking, is to do a couple of things. First, under the original law, we were to create a five-year power plan that would describe ways that Bonneville Power Administration should operate in terms of generation, acquiring new resources, and promoting conservation. As part of that power plan, the council was also to create a fish and wildlife program. That program was for the purpose of protecting, mitigating, and enhancing fish and wildlife in the Columbia Basin that is affected by the operation of the hydro system. But the program must do all that protection in a way that assures efficient, reliable, and cost-effective power for the region. I'd like to talk about two general areas of activity that the council's engaged in. First, the planning function. Talk a little bit about the new fish and wildlife program we've created and the provision that it makes for sub-basin planning. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about the project review and funding process that we're engaged in. And then finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about the areas that I've chosen to emphasize in my work on the council. First, turning to planning. As I said, the council is by law required to have in place a fish and wildlife program designed to mitigate for the impacts of the hydropower system on fish and wildlife. The program directs the way that Bonneville spends roughly $130 million per year for the purpose of fish and wildlife protection. The council makes recommendations to Bonneville on particular steps it should take consistent with the council's program. Before we make the recommendations, every project that we recommend funding is subjected to review by a panel called the Independent Science Review Panel, whose members are nominated by the National Academy of Sciences. And this panel is in place. Its membership changes over time, but it is a body which is independent of any of the potential seekers of funding, project sponsors, if you will, and is there to provide the best independent science review possible for the projects that might be recommended for funding. This past October, we completed the first major revision of the Council's Fish and Wildlife Program since 1995. The architecture of the program was to set out on a basin-wide level a vision, goals, and biological objectives. And this was largely to respond to criticism that the program in years past was essentially a loose collection of measures and that there was no scientific foundation that provided the needed coherence or structure. We have this new program that has the framework of the vision, goals, and objectives. The program itself will be implemented through detailed sub-basin plans that will be developed in each of the 50 sub-basins throughout the Columbia Basin. These plans will incorporate activities already underway that are consistent with the goals and objectives in the Council's Fish and Wildlife Program. The program has a strong emphasis on improving habitat and restoring ecosystems, not just species. The program supports reprogramming hatcheries, continuing to improve fish passage at dams, and assuring that harvest occurs in a manner that protects weak stocks. The program also addresses directly the impacts of hydropower on wildlife through such things as habitat acquisition and conservation easements. Regarding the sub-basin planning, as I said, this is how the program will largely be implemented, through the creation of the sub-basin plans, which will be developed locally. The plans will be consistent with the overall program's goals, objectives, and strategies, and they will provide the context for reviewing project proposals for Bonneville funding each year. The sub-basin plans will include three things. First, an assessment of historical and existing conditions. Second, an inventory of existing fish and wildlife projects ongoing in those sub-basins. And third, a 10 to 15 year management plan. The council plans to work collaboratively with the National Marine Fisheries Service, in particular on the sub-basin planning. It's important to note that in its 2000 biological opinion on the hydropower operations, NINST declared that it intended to rely heavily, and those words are in quotes, on the council's sub-basin planning process for the identification and development of off-site habitat mitigation opportunity. Just a word of explanation there for those of you who may not be aware. The biological opinion that the National Marine Fisheries Service issued this past December, which approved the operations of the dams on the Columbia River, conditioned that approval on Bonneville engaging in and funding what's called off-site mitigation. Essentially what that means is in order for Bonneville to get right with their obligations under the Endangered Species Act, they would have to facilitate and fund fish and wildlife projects that were ongoing throughout the basin or that might be proposed to be done throughout the basin that would have fish and wildlife benefits. What the National Marine Fisheries Service said in their biological opinion is they wanted Bonneville to identify those off-site mitigation opportunities through the council's sub-basin planning process. I personally think that's a very important step taken by the National Marine Fisheries Service because through Oregon's representatives on the Northwest Power Planning Council, we can have a state voice in guiding where Bonneville spends its money on these projects. And the amount of money that will be spent on these projects in the next 10-year period will likely be considerable. Another thing that that the National Marine Fisheries Service said in its biological opinion that I think provides the state of Oregon and the other states in the basin with an opportunity is that that Bonneville, quote, shall work with the council to ensure development and updating of sub-basin assessments and plans, match state and local funding for coordinated development of watershed assessments and plans, and help fund technical support for sub-basin and watershed plan implementation from 2001 to 2006. So again, This is a mandate from the National Marine Fisheries Service to Bonneville saying, as a condition for your continued operation of the hydro system, you must engage in this matching of state funds for these purposes and provide technical support. Again, opportunities for this state and the other states of the basin to obtain some financial support for some of the fish and wildlife activities, which are very important to this committee and to the legislature and the state as a whole. Since the council's 2000 fish and wildlife program was adopted this past October, the council staff has been hard at work on the logistics of how the sub-basin plans will be developed at the local level and within each of the four states. There are, of course, as this committee is well aware, many ongoing processes and programs in the state of Oregon that have the potential to dovetail with the council's process. For example, in Oregon, there's the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, which is integral in providing funding for watershed councils, technical assistance, access to information, and for providing a regional forum to coordinate fish and wildlife related activities. The council is having ongoing discussions with the state of Oregon and the tribes to determine the best approach for proceeding with sub-basin planning in the state while not duplicating or usurping existing programs. that bears repeating, because when we first started down this road, it was very clearly articulated and emphasized and reemphasized that it was incumbent upon the council in the way it structured its program and sub-basin planning to do it in a way that worked with the ongoing efforts in the state of Oregon. It was not the reverse. It wasn't the Oregon plan or the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board that had to change our process or procedures to comport with the council, but rather the reverse, since our program was just being formulated and it was far more appropriate for us to structure our program in a way which worked with the many ongoing fish and wildlife programs existing in Oregon as well as in the other three states. In determining what the needs are to make this effort a success in Oregon, the state, the council, and the tribes are working on determining what funding and activities are already being provided and finding the gaps. Identifying the gaps will help guide development of a funding package request to Bonneville for things like coordinators, technical writers, facilitators, and technical support. In addition, part of this discussion involves coordinating schedules of Federal Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act activities within the sub-basin planning effort. That multi-level and program coordination is ongoing in a variety of venues. Again, trying to use the sub-basin planning process as a means of harnessing a number of different activities that are going on, focusing on different statutory mandates, all of which bear upon fish and wildlife. The effort will be to try and use this sub-basin planning process to get all those processes better coordinated, better integrated, and having the folks that are working in, for example, the Clean Water Act TMDL process to start, to continue, and in some instances start talking with one another so that we can have an integrated approach. The second topic that I'd like to talk about is the project review and funding. This, of course, is a very important aspect because this is where we actually get activities funded on the ground to benefit fish and wildlife. We are moving away from our prior practice that has been in place for roughly 15 years, by which the projects were reviewed each and every year, both the old and the new project, and decisions made about whether to fund or continue funding. We are now going to move to a three-year funding cycle. We recognized after hearing an earful over many years from the folks who are out on the ground that if you ask them to basically put together a new budget every year and come into Portland and make their case for funding every year, it essentially took out 3 out of the 12 months that they had to actually get some work done. In some instances, with the weather and the on the ground season is of course quite a bit shorter than a full 12 months. So we're going to be reviewing these projects on a three-year cycle. What we've done is we've divided the Columbia Basin into 10 provinces, and we're going to review 3 provinces a year. This year we reviewed the Columbia Gorge province and the Intermountain province, which is up in northern Idaho and Montana. We're also going to review what's called the Plateau Province, which is includes John Day and the Deschutes, the Umatilla River basins. We recently completed our review of the Columbia Gorge Province, which of course includes Hood River and 15 Mile Creek on the Oregon side. I'm pleased to report that this year we were able to recommend funding in the Columbia Gorge province at a level of $5.7 million. Roughly $2.3 million of that will be expended on the Oregon side in the Hood River and 15 Mile Creek area. The recommended budget for O2 will be on the order of $6.2 million. That just represents expenditures in one area that encompasses Oregon sub-basins. As I said, we are going to move on later in the year to the Plateau Province, which also includes the Deschutes, John Day, Umatilla Basin. We've gotten quite a bit of high-quality project proposals, and we expect to make a good deal of dollars available in that area as well. Couple of more more words about the project selection process. This year, for the first time, we established a category called innovative projects. We thought this began actually in 1999. We thought it wise to set aside roughly $2 million of the annual $130 million pot to really encourage some, if you will, outside the box thinking. Innovative projects in the sense that it represented some new technology applied to fish and wildlife projects or existing technology that was being applied in a slightly different fashion. We received 66 proposals, requesting a total of about $20 million, and those have been those were forwarded for the for review by the Independent Science Review Panel, and the council, after taking account of the Independent Science Review, recommended funding for 9 projects, which pretty much went up to the $2 million, just slightly short of that. Several of these will be conducted in Oregon. Our recipients include the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation and IRZ Consulting of Hermiston.
Eric?
Yes.
Could I just interrupt a little bit? For our information, the Independent Science Review Panel that you refer to is not the IMSP that we refer to.
Right. It is not. It's very similar in structure and intent. The ISRP, the Independent Science Review Panel, is a body that is required under our federal law, and it is comprised of candidates that are nominated by the National Academy of Sciences, and they the ISRP reviews each and every project that comes before us for funding, and before we make our decisions and recommend funding the Bonneville, we have the benefit of that independent review.
Thank you.
In addition to the innovative projects, this year we also put out a solicitation for what we're calling high priority projects. This category was intended to respond to the urgency surrounding efforts to recover Endangered Species Act listed fish. In response to the solicitation for these so-called high priority projects, we received 96 proposals, ranging from replacing culverts to acquiring riparian habitat to testing selective fishing gear. After the ISRP, the National Marine Fisheries Service and the region's fish and wildlife managers reviewed all the projects. 14 projects totaling roughly $14.6 million emerged as the consensus recommendations to fund. These 14 projects were judged clearly to address imminent risk to an ESA listed or threatened species and also to have satisfied several other criteria that the council put forward, such as capable of being implemented quickly, having all the permits required, et cetera. The idea was to get something going that was going to provide quick benefits to ESA listed fish. In Oregon, the city of Scappoose, the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation, ODFW, the Nature Conservancy, the North Coast Land Conservancy, all proposed projects that were included within the consensus recommendations, and we will be taking up those proposals at our very next meeting in Portland, and we'll be making recommendations as a council to Bonneville as to which of these to fund. Finally, I'd just like to mention a few of the areas that I've chosen to emphasize as in my tenure on the council. First, I think it is very important that in making these fish and wildlife decisions, we assure that we have good science guiding us. And we're very fortunate in the work that we do to have an independent science body that can give us good, high-quality input. And that allows we as decision-makers to take that independent science review strongly into account when we make decisions about which way to go. Second sort of philosophy is probably too grandiose a term, but just sort of rules of engagement that I wanted to share with you is the need to seize opportunities. And I think that we need to have the right balance between having a good solid program in place and having the program really drive things. But also, I personally believe we need to be open to opportunities that present themselves. And sometimes they're going to come at you from all different directions, and they might present themselves in sort of non-traditional ways. But I think they're important opportunity if opportunities do present themselves. It's important to seize them. I'll give you one example that I worked on in particular involving a rancher in John Day. This was a gentleman who was very supportive of fish and wildlife recovery, all the riparian areas on his ranch, as his father before him, were in conservation easements. And through his activities, he had really, and his father before him, really paved the way to provide a good example for how we can work together. Sort of an interesting opportunity presented itself. The conservation easements that applied to his property had come up for renewal, and it was at that particular time that a neighbor of his was wanting to sell her ranch and move south. And this gentleman wanted to purchase the ranch. It was an adjacent piece of property, and he wanted to purchase it for his use. He came to us and said, if you will give me some advance, if you will, as a down payment on re-upping the conservation easements on my land, I will promise to do that, and I will also promise to set aside as conservation easements the riparian areas on this ranch that I'm seeking to purchase, which had not been had riparian protection previously. And he was seeking this advance, if you will, or this funding, because he needed it in order to move forward with the purchase of this adjacent ranch. Well, it was a little bit out of the ordinary, but it was an opportunity we thought that warranted moving forward. This was a person who had demonstrated their commitment to the program and to fish and wildlife, and so we were able to move forward in that slightly untraditional fashion, but we think it's going to have good benefits overall. Another important philosophy that I'm trying to promote is to widen funding opportunities. The money, the $130 million roughly, that the council has at its disposal to make recommendations regarding, has traditionally gone to projects that were sponsored by the region's fish and wildlife managers, the state, federal, and tribal fish and wildlife managers. And I think in large part those entities have good projects, good ideas, and execute those projects well. But because of the Oregon plan, because of the collaborative focus that we've taken in Oregon and that is really being taken elsewhere in this region, there are a great many other entities. There are cities, there are counties, there are individual landowners, a whole host of folks who have good ideas and who want to become engaged in fish and wildlife protection. And one of the ideas that I've really promoted, and it's not been a hard sell to my colleagues on the council at all, is to assure that other entities, apart from the traditional entities, have a full and fair opportunity to seek and obtain funding out of the considerable sum of money that the council controls. And then finally, it's been important to me, as I said during the course of my comments, to assure that what we do is compatible with the state programs, particularly the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, because for me, that is a significant achievement of the state of Oregon, and I want to have the programs and the dollars that the council controls be used in a way that lends synergy to the Oregon plan, complements it, helps with the funding effort. So that is something that we are at every juncture seeking to assure compatibility with the state programs and policies that that this committee and the Legislative Assembly and the governor are moving forward with. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think I've covered the topics I wanted to, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you. Representative King and Representative Ruth.
Wanted to know how far out you're doing your budgeting, for salmon recovery projects. The real point where I'm trying to go to is, with our low water California crisis, losses, in the energy system, I'm kind of concerned that that's going to take money out of availability for doing these kind of projects. And wonder if you can kind of give us a sense of how far out you're looking and, to what degree we should be concerned.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative King, that's a very good and timely question. The $130 million that I keep mentioning is actually the dollar figure that has been in place pursuant to a memorandum of agreement that expires October of this year. There is a real question, and at this point the answer is uncertain, exactly what the funding level will be as we move into the next year or the next 5 years. The Bonneville Power Administration has indicated publicly that they expect to spend at least $130 million, if not $10 or $20 million more than that, on what we call the direct program. The direct program is the $130 million, and we call it direct because it's money that Bonneville makes directly available to fund on-the-ground projects, and that's distinguished from money that Bonneville spends money that Bonneville loses from foregone revenues, for example, from spill and other types of programs like that. So we don't know for certain, but my best guess is that we will have something on the order of $130 million or more available.
For what period?
I personally believe that it is beneficial to have some idea of some stable funding level for some period of time. As I said, we've had a five-year period where the funding was prescribed under a memorandum of agreement. I would like to see another MOA executed for at least a five-year period where we are engaged with Bonneville to try and gauge their level of comfort with that.
And when I was saying, are you talking about 130 to 150 per annum or spread out over a five-year period?
It would be 130 per year, per annum.
Much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About three questions. Have we ever thought about unbundling power bills to the point where ratepayers would know how much of their power bill is going for fish recovery?
It's not, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, it's not something that that is reflected in anyone's power bill. My belief, though, Representative Cruz, is that funding for fish and wildlife benefits in all categories, that is to say direct expenditures, foregone revenues, et cetera, comprises roughly between 15% and 18% of the bills that Bonneville sends out to its customers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought that, but I don't think that information has ever been accurately given to the people who are actually paying the bill. I don't think the people of Oregon actually realize how much they're actually paying for salmon recovery. I think at some point that might be helpful. But you've led me into my next question, which is, have the drawdowns proven to be effective?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Drawdowns of the dams.
There have not been any drawdowns recently.
I know, but were they proven to be effective when they for fish passage, which is what they were done for?
The last drawdown that I'm aware of, which was done on an experimental basis at one of the lower Snake River dams, was back, I believe, in 1992. And I am not familiar with the exact outcomes.
I guess I thought we had done that more recently than that. My final question, Mr. Chair, and with the recent court decision on the Snake River dams, are you anticipating temperature challenge on the other dams in the system also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, I'm really not anticipating it one way or the other. It was a lawsuit that is brought by a consortium of environmental groups, and I don't, frankly, I wouldn't speculate as to what their next step is.
Okay, I guess so. You have heard nothing about anything pending at this point.
No,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? I'm not sure, Representative, we talk about the drawdowns. Are you talking about flow augmentation or ethylene? It's my understanding that we do this or have done this with some regularity.
Yes, forgive me, Mr. Chairman, if I might go back to Representative Cruz. I guess I was missing the terminology. Flow augmentation. The way that there are two principal means that we are currently using in the hydro system to benefit mostly salmon migration. One is spill, and one is flow augmentation. The most recent data that I'm aware of demonstrates that with regard to flow augmentation, there is some relationship between flow augmentation done in the spring and survival benefits, but that it is a, in the words of the National Marine Fisheries Service, which conducted the study, it is a weak relationship. With respect to the summer flow augmentation and that goes into the fall, this same study by the National Marine Fisheries Service demonstrates a far closer relationship between between the flow augmentation and survival benefit. With respect to spill, where water is spilled over, or really more precisely through the dams, through an opening rather than through the turbines, it really varies project by project. There are some projects, such as the dam at the Dalles, which, because it is suspected of its unique configuration, its spill is not very beneficial. But at other projects, the science, and particularly one of the independent science advisory board, which is another independent science board created under federal law that doesn't review projects but provides some independent scientific guidance on some of the key issues, that board has called spill the most beneficial way of passing juveniles downstream. Now, having said all that, we're sort of in a unique situation this year because of the power situation. And both flow augmentation to a small extent, but certainly spill, have an impact on our ability to generate power. One of the things that the council is looking at is providing both to the council members as well as to other policymakers in the region some good solid analysis of what the power impacts are of spill and flow this summer, and what the costs are. And we're hoping that in the highly likely event that we're going to have to make some hard choices this year, in other words, curtail the spill program, curtail the flow augmentation program, in order to keep the lights on, in order to keep some water in the reservoirs, how exactly to make those trade-offs in a way that does keep the lights on but also is least impacting on the fish that we're trying to recover, so that it sort of sets us back the least extent possible.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Are you no longer barging? Is that gone by the wayside?
No, I you're right, Representative Cruz. We are barging. In fact, a majority of Simon migrants are barged this year and in all years. So that is sort of the third way that we do things in order to get the salmon, the migrants, out. I was sort of trying to focus on spill and flow because those are the ones that really affect the way we actually operate the system.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that was kind of where I was trying to get it, because the barging is a viable way, and it is. We do have other ways to assure outpassage of fish with the environment we're facing this summer. So.
Right, and actually the biological opinion itself provides that where flows are extremely low, the opinion specifies below 85 kcfs, and that's in the summer. We're already pretty close to that in the spring, so we'll surely be below that in the summer. But in the event flows are that meager, because of the slowness of the water as well as the temperature, in those instances, every fish that we can get our hands on are going to be put on barges. That's just the way it would work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming when we're speaking of barging, you're talking of barging hatchery fish, not wild fish. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, the way that the collection occurs, we do not have the ability to distinguish between hatchery and wild fish. So all the fish that are collected are put on these barges for transportation, essentially around the turbines, if you will.
In other words, we got equal opportunity bargaining.
May I follow up?
Sure.
I'm not at all familiar with this, so how is that done? How do you corral these fish to put them on barges?
Well, there's a number of different sort of pieces of hardware that they use, but I couldn't really describe it in any meaningful way, but it's essentially things that we put on dams that some of them are below the water column, some of them are on the surface, and they manage to collect the fish and into a crowder, and they are put on these barges, and they're barged downriver so that they avoid having to go through the turbine.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I had a question.
Oh. Yes, Representative King.
Thank you. Maybe I'm off base, but I've had this conversation with a number of people, and I kind of wonder about it, too. With respect to, it's my understanding that the barge traffic doesn't know when we're going to be spilling, and that there's no regular pattern or amendable plan for when there's going to be high water, low water, and it just happens when it happens. And you know, it seems like there might be some sense to having some predictability, mm-hmm. some cycle, which of course has to be interrupted when there's, you know, a special need. But that makes a big difference if you're going up against, you know, heavy current, and that if there was some predictability in terms of when the barge traffic thought you were going to be dumping more water, that when one in the longer run we can save more water. You know, because they're trafficking, and also that it might diminish some of the need for dredging if we really have some, you know, some better coordination of that. And it doesn't seem like anything happens on that. Maybe there's a good reason why not, and you're my best shot at having some idea why. So if you help me out on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative King, To my knowledge, there is a fairly well documented routine to when we spill, how much we spill, and it is described on a project by project basis. Beyond that, there may be some irregularity within that overall structure that is presenting problems to some of the folks or constituents that you're hearing from. But I do know that if you look at the biological opinion and some of the other documentation, it does go through, and at each of the dams, it tells you, you know, is it 12-hour spill during the day, 24-hour spill, 12-hour spill during the night, some shorter duration, and exactly what the volume is. But I'd be happy to talk with you at some point and maybe find out more and maybe even
I'd appreciate being able to get a good handle on that if you're the right person to talk to or someone you would direct, and I know a number of the members are going to talk to some of the steamship operators tonight, and that's where I had some of those kinds of conversations before, and it really just seemed like it was kind of from there on potluck, you know.
Okay.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it. Okay, the Oregon Building Industries Association and John Chandler.
Oh, Lord.
Can I go now? Good afternoon. Now that you've been appropriately greeted by Representative Chandler.
I wouldn't feel loved if it didn't happen. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Chandler, land use specialist and, to my everlasting chagrin, salmon specialist for the Oregon Building Industry Association. With me today is Mr. Ernie Platt, who is the secretary of the OBIA and a former president of the Portland Home Builders Association. We really appreciate the chance to be here. We've got a project going that we're very excited about. We think you will be as well. We hope you will be. But and Mr. Platt will walk you through that. I want to give you a little bit of the background as to how we ended up here, because we've been trying to figure it out ourselves. Every now and again in life, you get an occasion where you thought you were there fat, dumb, and happy, and things were bad for somebody else, but it wasn't you. It turned out that we were involved in the salmon issue up to our eyeballs once it broke loose. We are a regulated industry. We represent 5,000 member firms around the state, builders, developers, and those who trade with them. And we're regulated on stormwater runoff, on erosion control, on all sorts of land use and other environmental things. When the salmon listing first became talked about several years ago, National Marine Fisheries Service started working on it. The state of Oregon started to respond to it first on the coast and the Columbia and then in the Willamette Valley. Various approaches were taken, including the formation of the Willamette Restoration Initiative, which I was a member of, trying to get our hands around how to respond to the impending, at that time, listing of salmon and steelhead runs in the Willamette Basin. When the 4D rule came out a year plus ago, their development was, right along with logging and agriculture and everybody else that we'd sort of been looking at and figuring it was really bad to be them, and there we were in the middle of the tussle ourselves as a regulated part of the federal approach to endangered species recovery. What we found when we were preparing our comments on behalf that we had attorneys hired, so if you have questions about the comments, I'll defer them. We prepared comments on the 4D proposal on behalf of the OBIA, and the Realtors, and others. And we found in the course, our attorneys found in the course of preparing their comments, that there really wasn't much science behind the urban regulation. There's volumes and shelf loads of science on timber, on ocean conditions, on river conditions, and so on, but very little as it relates to the urban environment and what impact, plus or minus, urban development has on fish morbidity and the survival of the salmon runs. That seemed to be a significant gap to us, since we were going to be regulated, we understood that, and we wanted to do whatever we could to do our part for the salmon recovery. We thought it would be appropriate to have some scientific basis for those regulations, which is why we're here today. We started this project, and I want to emphasize that it is a OBIA project only because we got the ball rolling. We are not. We would love to have somebody else take it over and run with it. We don't want to incur any suspicion on the part of some that it's a builder-driven, trying to get the right answer sort of a project. We were very specific with our science team. In fact, they were actually very specific with us that there was going to be no dictation of answers. This was going to be a scientific analysis of the impact of urban development, period. And whatever that science said was what the regulations we would hope would reflect, not the other way around. So it's we've worked since we got started. We started it, frankly, because we could move quicker as a private entity than a lot of public bodies could. But since we've been going, we've gotten a lot of support from local governments, both in terms of funding and in terms of field testing, the research. We're getting to that stage where it's ready to start doing some work on the ground to see if the scientific theory actually matches up with conditions on the streams. We've been in constant contact, where our science team has, with ODF&W, with National Marine Fisheries Service. We are including them in the peer review list for the scientific research. We expect them to be able to respond in an iterative fashion as to the research that we're doing, how it matches up with what they've seen, and make sure that the final product is one that is acceptable to them. And we're having conversations with OWEB about becoming part of the Oregon plan, or at least the science, part of the science behind the Oregon plan. What we've done, and Mr. Platt will walk you through this, you have packets in front of you helping to detail this, is we've retained a team of fish biologists that are very well respected, have all the right letters behind their names, have worked with NIMS and with the Forest Service and other federal agencies before, and Bonneville, and I think the Northwest Power Council as well. And what we've asked them to do is first do the research, find out what data is out there and where the data gaps are so we can help fill them, and secondly, to prepare it in such a way that it can be a useful tool. In fact, we're calling this a science-based tool. Our intention, our hope is that when we're all done, we'll be able to have something that planners, land use people, government entities can use with the approval of National Marine Fisheries Service to regulate land use in urban areas along streams and rivers in the best way for salmon. And it'll be my layman's concept, a template that you can apply fairly quickly, fairly easily, that the local government won't have to go to a whole bunch of expense, but we'll be able to apply this in most cases on the ground in a way that gets the process of regulation and development going forward. With that, I will hush. We'll take questions later. I'll turn it over to Mr. Platt to walk you through the packets.
Okay. Again, Ernie Platt, representing Oregon Zillion Industry Association. Good afternoon, Chair Jensen and committee members. let me just walk you through the information that was in the package that was distributed to you. The cover letter on Oregon Building Industry letterhead pretty much says in about 250 words less than what John just did, our mission and why we undertook this project. The next document is probably 28 pages long or so. Citizen's Guide to the 4D Rule. This is National Marine Fisheries Publication, put out by them, not any one of us. I would direct you to just two or three sections in that report. Page number three are some maps that indicate the areas that are directly affected by the so-called 4D rule. It pretty much covers all of Oregon and Washington and most of Idaho, and then Northern California, the Sacramento drainage basin, and the mid-county areas of California. So about all of Oregon that's not included is the southeastern corner. On page four, upper right-hand corner, is our definitions of take, harass, and harm. They really cut to the chase on this, what NMSA said, thou shall not take an endangered species. And take is defined basically as kill, but it also is harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, trap, capture, or collect. And then in particular, page five, are a list of about 16 activities that the National Marine Fisheries Service has now deemed to be possibly creating the take of the endangered species. I would direct you to number A, constructing and maintaining structures, culverts, berms, and dams that eliminate or impede the movement of the endangered species. Item D, removing or altering rock, soil, gravel, or vegetation from the stream riverbeds. Item J is my particular favorite. Conducting land use activities that may disturb the soil. I submit, name one that doesn't. So, with that, my point being, National Marine Fisheries Service has inserted themselves directly in our daily lives of everything we do on land in those areas covered by that map. The next document, actually there's three parts to it that are stapled together. The scientific team that we have assembled under the direction of Steve Kramer. The principal members of the team are listed in bios on all of them. I'll leave you to read those on your own. There's quite a wide range of disciplines covered. Then, let's see, fourth page in, but they're not numbered that way, is an outline of the project as the science team has undertaken it. Basically, phases one and two are now complete. In other words, a draft version of their endeavor is now available, and we are moving into phases three, and then we'll be made ready to move into phase four later this year. Phase three being, the basic report is undergoing peer review as we speak, so it's not ready. The full report's not ready for release until that gets accomplished. Then phase three is just beginning, and that is the selection of some representative watersheds around the region, and that could be anywhere in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Northern California, where in the roadmap, the template, as John called it, can be put to the test. See if it works. See if it works without flaw. And those watersheds are being selected as we speak. And then phase four will ultimately be reducing this information to a ready-to-use format that cities, counties, and any special district and other governmental jurisdiction charged by NMS with enforcing these regulations could incorporate that information in their development codes,
other ordinances that they may operate under, that if they do that, if those cities and counties do that, submit those codes to National Marine Fisheries, National Marine Fisheries will deem them to be in compliance with the requirements of the 4D rule. In other words, if they approve developments that comply with those regulations, they will be deemed not to creating the take of the fish. And finally, the very last page there is just a very, very abbreviated outline of the work of the scientific team. Next in the packet is a letter on Washington County letterhead from Mr. Brent Curtis, Planning Director. Basically, in so many words, Washington County is currently undergoing the periodic review with respect to Goal 5. And Brent relates that, in so many words, that this piece of work will become the body of science that will enable them to create the endangered species element of their Goal 5 their update and periodic review. And I would offer that every city and county and every jurisdiction in the state of Oregon is going to find a similar already. The next document is a photocopy of an article appeared in the Daily Journal of Commerce in December, basically relating this undertaking, and there's interviews with quite a goodly number of people and their comments about this work. All recognize it's nearly a Herculean task to try to do this, and wish us luck, and said somebody had to do it. This needs to happen. And the document headed Predicting Effects of Land Use on Salmon Production, Preliminary Executive Summary. This is an executive summary of the report that's undergoing peer review. I'm not going to try to walk you through it. It's pretty heavy reading, I think you find quite interesting things in correlation with the previous testimony I think you heard earlier, that the amount of water in the stream, in the river, has everything in the world to do with this discussion. The ability of the stream, in order to maximize the ability of a stream or a river to carry the endangered species, it's predicated on that stream carrying the food that species needs. The amount of food in the river or stream is diminished by low flow. It's diminished by too much shade cover, which cools the water. It's too much. It's enhanced by water that is active and rolling over rocks. It's aerated and the like. It also will say that the endangered fish habitat, as suggested by National Marine Fisheries, is grossly overstated. It also points out that the endangered species are only in certain places within a watershed at certain times of the year. And perhaps activities that might occur, if they occur opposite those times, there might not be the creation of the take.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, and quite a few other things.
I could back you up for a minute where you said that you can have too much shade.
Yes.
That is one of your findings, that you can have too much shade. I find that just incredibly interesting, Mr. Chair. I think that's something worth investigating.
Is that in the summer or the winter?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. And then just one final point to make. The colored document that's in there was printed with Oregon Building Industry, but together with National Association of Home Builders in Washington, D.C. It's basically a layman's document to understand what the 4D rule says. It's what it's meant to be. And it's much easier reading than the hard document itself. But just out of curiosity, let me point you to two things in this document. On page 9 is a listing of
requirements in the process of the development of land that we already. Local, state, and federal. And then throughout the document, there are bullet boxes that are, the boxes that are called reality checks, but they're summarized on the last page, on page 16. Between now and 2025, we have 1.2 million more people headed to the state of Oregon, 2.4 million headed to the state of Washington. Between now and the year 2010, we have 233,000 more people headed to the Portland metro area, 384,000 to the Puget Sound metro area. Between now and 2010, we have the need for an additional 93,200 dwelling units or households in the Portland metro area. I submit to you that that train has already left the station. Those statistics are going to happen, irregardless or notwithstanding or however we choose to interface with the requirements of the Endangered Species Act and the 4D rule. With that, I think I'll leave it to John to either summarize or deal with any questions if you have any at this point.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, just to summarize briefly, the reason we're here is basically twofold. First, a lot of discussion around the Endangered Species Act has focused, as is natural, around timber agricultural land. Part of our intent today is to make you aware that there is a significant urban component on the regulatory side and on the problem-solving side, that we realize that, as stated in the 4D rule, the disturbance of dirt, which is inherent in what we do for a living, is part of, at least in the view of the National Marine Fisheries Service, the salmon problem. Therefore, development is part of the salmon solution. The statistics that Ernie just gave you at the very end there about the number of people coming to Oregon in general, Portland in particular, elsewhere in the state by extrapolation of those same numbers, is going to happen. It's going to happen here. It's going to happen in Washington. This is the first time, and you all know this, I'm sure, that the Endangered Species Act has been applied at this level to a migrating water-based species in urban areas. This is a huge problem for the development community because we've never been here before. We don't know how the rules apply to us. Other cases where urban development has been in play in an ESA context have been in California or Texas or someplace where it was a specific area, a specific creature, and even if the migrating patterns might be of some question, it was a discernible, discrete part of the development picture. Here, between 70% and 80% of the population of the state of Oregon lives within the Willamette drainage, is affected directly or indirectly by the Endangered Species Act. Every major city in the state, save Bend, is directly affected by this. Medford is in play under different listings. From Eugene North is clearly at risk. We have coming at us in all of those jurisdictions the implementation of the Clean Water Act, Phase 2, and additional heightened requirements that will impose on smaller jurisdictions than they've had to comply with before. The NPDES standards, all the other things you've heard about, what we're attempting to do with this is to get our industry ahead of the curve in a way that is supportive of and not conflicting with the need to protect and preserve the species. That's been our fundamental position from the outset. It continues. And the second reason, just to be perfectly blunt about it, is that this effort has taken over $300,000 and going up that we don't have. We are looking for help both from the local government level and from state government to help fund this research. We've gotten assistance from the National Association of Home Builders, from other industry groups. We are wanting to make you all aware of that, though, because we believe it's going to be a valuable tool. We believe it'll be part of the Oregon plan, at least as far as a scientific basis for that plan is concerned. And we won't be passing the hat in the committee because that's tacky, but to the extent that you know there is a piece of work out there that is deserving of support, we would like to make you aware of it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude and take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Representative King.
I'm really impressed that you guys did this, and I think that anybody that builds to some degree is part of habitat problems and water quality problems. On the other side, I don't think your industry gets enough credit for by your nature being part of the solution, because the more we have urban density, the more, you know, wildlife and habitat area, you know, remains. And so, you know, to a certain degree, I think part of your function is, you know, is helping in the process. The other part is, you know, is I'm having a bit of an epiphany. You know, looking at John is almost a fish scientist here this morning. And we got all these 50-cent words in this, you know, pretty heavy-duty document. And I was wondering if I could get some help on the rearing densities equation of the quantity of fish divided by m squared. Maybe later it'd be okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, absolutely not. Not. I have been up to this point extremely proud of the fact that I have not had a science class since my sophomore year of high school, and I didn't understand that one. I do know that I have access to people who can come explain rearing densities divided by M,
right,
or whatever it was.
Well, I noticed you brought your chauffeur with you. I'm sure you know.
Any other questions that might have some merit to discussion?
Don't forget to factor in your woody debris complexity and your percent of cobbles, because those are important, too.
Okay. I know that the use of voodoo science, I'm curious if this voodoo science is going to have the same effect as the voodoo economics of a few years ago. We'll take that discussion.
Yes, thank you.
So I guess the good news and the bad news is I'm a member of an industry that also kind of disturbs the soil some, and because I don't know how you farm without doing that. And we've been dealing with this for a lot longer than you folks, and we still don't know what the hell they're expecting from us. So I don't think it matters when you join the game. You're going to be just as confused as everybody else. So
I would respectfully advise the representative from Roseburg that over in Eastern Oregon, we nurture soil. We don't disturb it. We nurture it along.
So it's just terminology. It's all it takes. Yeah, we can change that.
Your witness has a bust of hands, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you.
Thank you all very much.
Yeah, that's true. Okay,
we'll close the informational meeting and go to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 302. And staff will advise us what we're doing here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 302.
You're in the front.
Senate Bill 302 is exempting activities, annual activities, that affect less than 1 cubic yard of material or any particular site and less than 5 cubic yards within an essential habitat segment from the general authorization permit requirements.
And
it declares an emergency upon passage.
Declares an emergency. Okay, and we have Jeanette Holman, here from Division of State Lands, I think, to testify on this bill. I assume it's in that capacity, is it?
Yes.
Thank you. We would appreciate it, Jeanette, if you would try to leave all of the scientific jargon out of this, because it can get us apparently off track.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been almost as long for me as for John. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeanette Holman, an assistant director at the Division of State Lands. I'm here today to tell you a little bit about the background of Senate Bill 302, which was introduced at the request of the division. In 1993, Mr. Chair, this is new to me, so. In 1993, the legislature changed our removal fill program and directed the agency to identify essential indigenous salmonid habitat throughout the state. And in these areas, the division could no longer allow the under 50 cubic yards exemption for removal fill activities. In other words, anybody disturbing any of the material in those areas would have to have a permit. In 1997, the legislature again amended these laws to allow an exemption for prospecting, non-motorized prospecting activities in those areas, so long as they were they disturbed less than 1 cubic yard of material at one site and not more than 5 cubic yards in a designated segment in 1 year. The division found that it was not probably good public policy to require other activities of the same scale to have that requirement to have a permit. So we asked that this bill be drafted. We call it the Tonka Truck Bill because it's for very small uses in these areas to exempt them from the requirement for a permit. Without this, then technically someone who is a child playing on a beach or on the shore of one of these areas filling up a bucket could be required to get a permit, which doesn't seem like good public policy. There's a lot better places for us to spend our limited staff time. Mm-hmm. And so we are asking that the legislature adopt this amendment to the bill, to the statute. The bill passed the House side, or the Senate side, unanimously in the committee and with 28 votes in the Senate floor. I'd be happy to answer questions.
It seems to me that if we do this, we're missing a golden opportunity for kids at a very young age to be able to interact with the regulatory process of the state of Oregon. I guess one question, you do know some Tonka trucks are motorized, so obviously they would have to get a permit if they're going to use one of the motorized Tonka trucks, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Cruz, would we need a LC opinion on whether there's a liability here on this?
A more serious note, I mean, this falls right in line with everything we did with the mining industry.
Absolutely.
Last session. This just kind of fills in the picture.
Absolutely.
Okay. I have no questions.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302 and open the work session.
Mr. Chair?
On Senate Bill 302.
I move Senate Bill 302 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz has moved Senate Bill 302 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, I was tempted to ask who was it drew up the regulations that we had them in the first place, but I didn't do that. Let's go ahead and vote.
There's always holes.
Big holes.
There's always a possibility they may come back and draft other, you know, for future sessions.
I intend to support this bill, Mr. Chair.
No.
Are you willing to carry it? We need to
vote. Sure, take the easy one.
Take the easy one.
That's right.
Very smart. You can leave the heaviest
sure.
Heavy one.
Before we can let you do that, Representative, maybe we have to have a motion here to
got a motion.
We're fighting over having yeah. Motions.
Yeah, I moved it.
Okay. With the due pass.
Yes, we did.
Okay, any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cruz? Aye. Representative Smith? Aye. Representative Worth? Aye. Representative King? Aye. Representative Cummings? Representative Cummings? Aye.
Representative Leonard? Excuse.
Representative Lee? Aye.
And having a volunteer?
Yes.
Representative Tomei will carry the bill. Okay.
I thought we were going to have a motion to put it on the consent calendar just until we had it.
Yeah.
Willing volunteer.
Close the session on Senate Bill 302, and where are we at? 250.
We're ready.
We're done.
I'm not.
You got one more?
We do?
302?
We did it.
Yeah, I'm on.
We did it before you got here.
I only have written testimony for one.
Yeah, we did. We just did a hearing and they testified.
Having no other business that we can attend to in the committee today, the SR2 committee is closed.